I was saying the carpenter had to be a knew what he was doing. He had to be more or less a skilled person. I have the feeling today that any man who can wield a hammer calls himself a carpenter. And he goes out and makes a very, very good hourly wage. Back in those days, you were not a carpenter until the man you were working for as an apprentice said you were a carpenter. You worked an average of 5 to 10 years before you were called a carpenter. You had to be able to do magic with a square, for example. I recall one man whom I will not name. He didn't have a great school education, but he was an absolute magician with a square. He could do all sorts of problems, and he built houses and built them solid and square. There's one other thing I might mention. Not only in the building trade, but in all phases of work. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. You can correct me if you think so. But it seemed to me, back in the good old days, men had a certain pride in their work. Whatever work they did it with pride. They were determined to do a good job. Part of that came through necessity, because if you didn't do a good job, soon you didn't have a job. But I think there was this innate pride in workmen of those days who were determined they were going to be known as a man who did good work. Whether you're a carpenter or a bricklayer. Bricklayers back in those days laid brick as fast and as well as they could. I don't know if you know it or not, but today there's a limit to the number of bricks you're permitted to lay in a day. And that's determined by the union, which says this is the maximum number of bricks we will let you lay in one day, period. In the old days, you laid as many bricks as you could and did them the best you knew how. That goes along with the feeling that I have that men produced what they could, the best they could, and they'd like to be known for doing this type of work.
Would you think that possibly a higher moral standards in those days existed also, which...
I think that's unquestionable. I think when you speak of moral standards, I think the family was a much more integrated, a necessary part of life. If you didn't have a family, you were footloose and fancy-free. I don't know about morals, speaking of morals, actually, men drank, men ran around, but for the main part, they came back to the families and supported the family, and a man normally was the head of his family. Whether that's good or bad, I don't know. I'm not here to say. But most men today, I don't think you refer to as the head of the family. The wife is out working and perhaps making more money than the husband is. I don't think there is hardly such a thing as the head of a family anymore. But it used to be that the man was regarded as the head of the family. You're very proud to be named as the head of the family. Do you agree with this?
No question.
So you speak of morals as far as morals go. I don't imagine that morals have changed over the
centuries. Well, I was thinking of morals in the sense of honesty and corruption. I wasn't thinking in terms of drinking or sex or something.
No, in terms of honesty, I think there was a necessity for honesty that was generally recognized. If you weren't honest, you soon gained a reputation that was not too great. This, in turn, would affect your livelihood. And today, people gravitate from one place to another, from job to another, and people are free to get in the automobile and go, or get on the airplane and fly to another state. It was not so. You were closely confined by your own immediate area, I think, in those days, in the town. A lot of men never got out of their town except to go to perhaps a fair, it's not the fall, in the fall time, they went to a fair at Great Barrington or someplace else. Mm-hmm. But men hardly moved out of the village or town in which they lived.
And there was concern for what the community thought of you, other people thought of you?
Yes, indeed, of necessity.
Now, how much participation was there, let us say, in town hall meetings and community decisions? And
there was a great awareness of what went on in the town, and I believe town meetings were much better attended in the old days than they are now. Now a budget of a few million dollars is passed by perhaps 8 or 10 people. But I've seen the old town hall jammed to the rafters on many occasions. And I think the people had, again, had a pride in taking part in the affairs of the town. I think, unfortunately, I think we've lost that now. I think the so-called natives have become apathetic, and I believe that newer people from the cities are more interested, and I believe they've taken over the affairs of the town, and rightfully so.
But what brought on this apathy? Why? Now, there are several things that occur in this respect. The younger people, native people, do they move away or do they settle here?
Well, now you're speaking I will speak of two different times. It, traditionally, the younger people did not move away. They stayed and perhaps inherited a share in the farm upon which they grew up. Now there is very little of this farm life, and the young people, when they grow up, find there is nothing to do here, so they must take off for the city somewhere. So we're losing our young people very, very rapidly. This may account, in a way, for the apathy that seems to be to prevail in the town affairs. I'm not sure that this is true, but it certainly, I believe it has effect. My own two children loved this area, this town, so much. But when they grew up, there was nothing for them to do, so they just had to leave. And then the influx of people from the city is well known. And these people, although many of them are weekenders, are vitally interested in the affairs of the town. And as I said before, they have taken over the affairs of the town, and I must say, rightfully so. We have abdicated, the old timers have abdicated our former positions of power and interest. And I guess it's a sign of the times.
No, it's not me. Okay. Let's go back to something here about the working conditions. You mentioned that the years were from 1919 approximately through the 30s, which means that you were working during the period of the Great Depression. How did that affect this area?
I would say, I personally happened to be away during the early years of the Depression. I came back just at the end of the Depression. But I would think that the town of Salisbury was very, very little affected, very, very unaffected, largely, by the Depression. Things always moved slowly. In the old days, they still do. And there was a certain number of things that had to be done. So those things were done, whether Depression or no Depression. So I feel that we were not nearly as much affected by the Depression as were the city area.
Now, were most people still farmers in those
areas? Days? Yes, there were almost countless farms. Many small homes had 8 or 10 acres out behind their home, and they had a half a dozen cows and 4 pigs and a couple of horses, and you might call those farms. They were not typical farms, but the larger farms, of course, operated on a larger scale. And there must have been 20 or 25 good-sized farms in the town of Salisbury. Now I think there are perhaps a half dozen. So, but back in those days, you did have the farm work to fall back on, I think. People had more of a tendency to live off the soil than they do today. Today, everyone goes to the supermarket and picks just about everything off the shelf. Not so in the old days. In my own particular family, we always had a large garden, and a vegetable garden. And those vegetables were very, very assiduously grown and eaten during the summer months and canned for the winter months. People canned fruit and vegetables to a large extent. You almost lived off your little garden. All you needed was a bit of meat, coffee, sugar, and a few of those items. But the vegetable garden, people lived off. No more. This is not true anymore. So we have a change of life manner. It's entirely different than it was, I'm saying, just let's say 50 years ago. Entirely different.
In that respect, and at least in my view, looking at history with sympathy, I'm not interested in comparing it with today, the conditions of work that you experienced at that time, did you find that they were satisfactory? What was the pay scale? Was the pay scale something that people accepted? If you wanted a raise, did you go see the boss on your own by yourself, or did a few of you go in together, and so on?
I think that I never heard of an instance where a few people went in together. I think if you were working for a farmer, for example, I think if you had one child and suddenly you had two or three children, you probably went to the boss and said, look, my family is getting larger, I need to have some more money. And I would say that 99 times out of 100, the boss farmer, or whoever he happened to be, would say, yes, I understand. You're going to have a little more money from now on. Maybe one of your children will have to work on the farm a little bit to help out, but certainly I understand your position, you have to have a little more money. I never heard of any contention over money. Farmhands were paid about so much, whether they worked on this farm or that farm, and I never heard. If there was a farmer in town that was notoriously poor payer, it was found out, and he would have a hard time getting anyone to work for him. Therefore, everyone paid what was considered a fair wage, a living wage. It was different. It was different. There was no groups going and saying, hey, we got to have more money. It just didn't work that way.
You mentioned before about bricklayers, for instance, that one could lay as many bricks, one would lay as many bricks as he could within the time of his work, which seems to indicate that one bricklayer may lay, let's say, 20 bricks more than the other. Were they paid according to the bricks they laid?
Originally, they were paid for the number of bricks they laid. The last I knew, which was quite some years ago, the bricklayers union, they were only allowed to lay, I think it was 1,500 bricks a day. Prior to that ruling by the union, it was possible for a good bricklayer to lay 3,000 or 4,000 bricks in a day. When they finally organized themselves and they said, this is all you can do, what are you going to do? If you want to get a building built, you must employ union labor. And naturally, the cost of the building goes up. The less work is done. So they just dawdle along and lay their 1,500 bricks, and that's it. That applies to all kinds of work.
But in coming back to those days, if you had two workers and one laid 100 bricks and one laid 80 bricks, did they get a different salary, or?
No, I think in a case like that, it would soon be known that Joe laid more bricks than any other man on the job. He'd probably become a foreman one of these days. He wouldn't have to lay any bricks at all. He'd just go and tell the other guys to work a little harder. But there again, I think every man knew that he must produce a reasonable amount of work, otherwise he was out of the job. And there again, the pride comes in. Every man has pride, I don't care who he is. And I believe that pride Come back to the bricklayers. I think their pride was overcome by the ruling of the bricklayers union. I think a good many men gave up laying bricks because they couldn't do the job they really liked to do. I really think so.
Let me get some very specific questions in. That was a very good description. First, I would like to get an idea. Let's say when you were maybe 7 years old, if you can recall that, what a day was like. What time did you get up? What chores did you have to do? What did you have for breakfast? Go through the whole day.
Well, let's take seven years of age. I probably woke up about the time my father left the house for work. And I dressed.
And that was what time?
I probably woke up at 6:30 or so, something of that sort. In the wintertime, I could certainly remember I ran to the stove and dressed by the stove because it was so frightfully cold in my bedroom that many times I saw snow driven through the window or underneath the window into the bedroom, you know. So we would grab our clothes and run down beside the stove and dress there. My family was very, very poor. I can't imagine anyone being any poorer than we were. But we always had enough to eat. And we always had, if not acceptable, clothes that kept us warm, kept the elements out anyway. For breakfast, many mornings, some of the good mornings, we had pancakes. All the pancakes you could eat with maple syrup or molasses on the pancakes. Or it might be oatmeal, which I still love today. A good big portion of oatmeal with either whole milk or cream, maybe a little fruit if we had fruit around. And then, of course, you're saying at 7 years old, at seven, I would get dressed and have breakfast and off to school.
Which meant walking how far?
Well, one instance I had to see, I never walked less than a mile. I think the farthest I had to walk was about a mile and a half. And this was, of course, a lot of fun, especially in the spring, summer. Lots of the winter, it wasn't so much fun. In many cases, we had to walk through deep snow. And there again, if you had someone to walk with, it was sort of fun, unless it was a raging blizzard. We didn't have any snow days back in those days. We had school, whether there was snow or no snow. So, spend your 5 hours in school and come home, and you asked about the chores.
Did you have lunch in school? Or,
you know, no, we took our own lunch.
Gotcha.
But one happy thing, when I went to the Taconic School, there was a house right next to the school, and they provided hot cocoa, or something which I never had since, but which I loved. It was called potato soup. I don't know what it was made of. But it was delicious, absolutely delicious. And we brought it over in big cans. We carried one big can in each hand. Whoever was appointed to go over there and get it, get either the hot cocoa. And this was a government subsidy back in those days. It was for a while. Then it seemed to me we had to pay a nickel for our cup of soup or cocoa. I'm not sure when that changed, but I feel that it was a state or a government subsidy, or provided by some wealthy person in the town. Maybe even the Scoville family provided, but I'm not sure. But for all the winter that I went to the school in Taconic, we had this hot cocoa or hot soup, which the older boys, eighth grade boys, two of them would go over and get. They were appointed to go and get the cocoa, so forth. So that was a help, really. Then, you speak of chores. I think every kid had certain duties to do. In the summertime, I had to work in the garden, for example. My father would tell me the night before, When you come home from school, you will hoe these beans, these four rows of beans, or you'll hill these 10 rows of potatoes, or you'll stake up the tomatoes, put some stakes in and tie them up. Or you will pick the potato bugs off the potatoes, or you will get the kindling wood in to start the fire in the morning. It's your job to keep the kindling wood, a good supply of kindling wood on hand. Or you will mow the lawn, the lawn needs mowing. There's always something to do. Or, we didn't have running water in the house, you will go to the spring and get water as morning and night. That was the hard side, but now the happy side came after my chores were done. But my chores,
you did your chores after you came home from
after
school.
After I came home from school.
About what time?
After I came home from school.
About what time?
Well, I get home from school, I suppose, 3:30 or so.
Okay.
Yeah. So I did my chores.
Yeah.
Then I could do anything I wanted. Anything at all. I had a few friends. We'd go out in the woods with a BB gun, shoot at birds, which I later learned not to do. Or we'd start a fire, or we'd climb a tree. One of the big things we did was climb a birch tree. We called it swinging birches. Have you ever done it?
Yeah.
That's a wonderful thing. Kids don't do much of that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You climb up the birch tree as high as you can until the thing bends over and lets you down to the ground. So it was a happy childhood, very, very happy childhood. In the winter months, you didn't have so much any garden work to do, but you still had to keep the kindling supplied and the water and so forth, and perhaps help with the wood for the stove. Then we'd go sliding or skating. And we had skating parties at night, and we had more fun. We had more fun, I can't begin to tell you how much fun. It was a happy life.
Yeah. What time did you have dinner?
Well, usually not until my father got home, and that would be about 6 o'clock or so. When he started working, getting through at 5, we'd eat about 6 o'clock when my father got home. No one ate until he got home, that's for sure. So,
and then after that, after dinner?
After that, there was schoolwork, homework. And this was the unwritten rule. And my father checked my homework and my sister's to see that it was done. And this was as regular as clockwork. You did your homework, and we had quite a bit of homework to do. And my father always checked to make sure it was done. That was another interesting thing. If I had any trouble with a teacher, I was in double trouble with my father. I never knew him to support me against a teacher. The teacher was always right. No matter how wrong she might be, the teacher was right. And I grew up that way, feeling, knowing that the teacher was right. I think it's a good lesson.
You never knew that the teacher was wrong.
I had a suspicion on some occasions that the teacher was wrong.
Well, how did you feel then?
Well, the reason why I say the teacher was always right is if I complained to my father, I got nowhere. I got nowhere. If the teacher wrote a note, which I don't remember she ever did, but if she ever wrote a note saying I was bad, I did something really bad, I would get in real big trouble. Real big trouble with my life. In that case, the teacher was always right. If she said I did something wrong, I did it. There was no way out of this.
Yeah.
My father always supported the teacher.
But your own feelings, if you can recall an instance, a teacher can be wrong sometimes. Can you recall an instance when a teacher was wrong in your case? Now, of course, that's not necessarily.
Truthfully, I don't think I can.
Yeah.
In retrospect, I think I'm forced to admit that the teacher was right.
Always right.
Sometimes, right at the moment, yeah, it seemed like she was too stern.
Uh-huh.
But, as I say, thinking over all those years ago, I think she was 99.44% right.
And the teacher had a standing in the community at that time.
She had an excellent standing.
You mentioned that one of your teachers was Mrs. Holmes. I forgot, you used a different name.
Actually, she was never my teacher. I was in the upper grades when she came to the school.
Oh, I see.
Her name was Getting, G-O-E-T-T-I-N-G, later Mrs. Holmes. But at that time, I had a teacher named Fish. Edna Fish, and I didn't mention it before, but I never had a mother. My mother died when I was 22 months old, so I never had a mother. So when I went to school at the age of 5,
So your father then raised the family.
Yes,
there
he
was
did.
No mother yeah. or mother substitute.
No,
in
there was all the mother substitute we had was a housekeeper.
Right.
So I went to school at the age of 5, and I evidently needed a bit of mothering, and this teacher, Mrs. Fish, mothered me because I was a little scrawny waif of a thing without a mother, and I'm sure she felt sorry for me, so she would put her arms around me. And this was, one of the warmest feelings I ever had in my life was when I got this mothering from my teacher. So I couldn't really complain that this lady ever did anything very wrong. Some other kids got in trouble with her, but I never got much trouble yet. So she gave me something that I really needed at that time. But that's getting far. I don't want to get on the purpose.
Coming back to the daily schedule, what time did you go to bed?
Well, let me tell you, there was no radio. There was no TV. So after I had my homework done, I might read a book, and I'm sure that I was in bed, unless I was going to a skating or a sliding affair, I'm sure I was in bed by 10 o'clock.
And that was pretty fixed?
It wasn't fixed by rule. No, it was not fixed by rule.
Just by habit.
Just by habit, more or less. If I stayed up late, I'm sure my father would say, hey, time for bed. And one of the things about my father was, I never argued with him, and he never laid a hand on me. All he ever had to do was, he held up his finger like this, and that's all he ever had to do. I knew what it meant, and I never disputed it. And that ensued until I was 25 years old. I never gave him a hard time. All he had to do was hold up the finger. That's all she wrote.
What was the kind of reading you did, not at 8-7, but let's say in your teens and so on? What were, do you recall any authors or books that you read?
Well, unfortunately, I was not near enough to, for example, the Scopel Library to get books from the library. But we did have a little library in our church in Taconic. And the first books I can remember reading, I think, were the Hardy Boys.
Oh, yes.
And the Frank Merriwell series.
That's sure.
And I've forgotten the titles, but books of that nature. Incidentally, this little library that I spoke of at the Union Chapel in Taconic was kept supplied with books by the Scoville family. They'd get a bunch of books in, and they'd probably stay there for 2 or 3 years, and maybe those books would go, and they'd bring some other books in. So they probably came from the Scoville Library here. I don't know. But that was all about the only book I read, Black Beauty, I just can't recall, but things of books of that nature. Frank Merriwell, I remember that, Yale, and very light, moralistic reading at that time.
I wanted to get that myth story that you were going to tell about storms on the roof into this tape.
This was a very interesting thing that I learned at a very early age. And I give it to you not as fact, but as a myth. However, I'd like to say that there is a foundation for this myth, inasmuch as similar instances happened in various parts of the country, and not only in this country, but in Europe. And as I recall, and from what reading I have done, it occurred in Central Europe. And my father always referred to it simply as stones on the roof. And how this came about here in this area and came to my knowledge was like this. On the Undermountain Road, which is Route 41, where Route 41 just comes into Massachusetts at a place called Sage's Ravine. Sage's Ravine, the road crosses Sage's Ravine, then you're now in Massachusetts on Route 41 going north. On the left-hand side of the road, just before you get to the Sage's Ravine, stood a cottage, a medium-sized house, well up off the road, I'd say probably 25, 30, or maybe 50 yards off the road on the left, sat up on the height over the road. And an old lady lived there, had lived there for a good many years, apparently alone, although I am relatively sure of her name. I won't mention it, because I could be wrong, and I would like to be right, so I won't tell her name. But various people went to visit her now and then, you know, as neighbors always did. And she began to tell the neighbors that she was very, very disturbed at something that had been happening two or three times. And they wanted to know what in the world it was. So she said, "In the middle of the night, I hear stones coming down on my roof." Sure enough, upon searching out below the roof of the house, they found stones, 2 or 3 inches in diameter, several of them, on several occasions. And this poor lady was very, very frightened, because out of nowhere, and in the middle of the night, down would come stones on the roof. For what reason? No one ever found out. But this was told to my father by someone who was very, very close to the old lady. So my father accepted it as fact that the stones did indeed fall on the roof. He never knew why, and nor do I. But as I said, in Central Europe, it is a myth, and they call it simply stones on the roof. And it seems to be a foreboding of ill. In some ways, it's certainly not a happy thing, but it seemed to prophesy a death in the family sometime soon. And that's what, of course, the old lady was worried about. She finally died of old age. But I thought it worthy of mention, yes, because I'm sure that someone will hear this tape someday, mm-hmm, yes, and they will remember that they have read of instances like this, which occurred in Batavia, I think, of Central Europe, the Czechoslovakia area. That's where it seemed to occur. Also in west of Germany, this thing was known to have happened.
First time I've heard that one.
I have read about it. I'm sorry that I didn't pay much attention to it when I read about it, so that I could authenticate it. But that is simply a little myth that I'd like to pass on.
I'm glad you included that. In your in a previous tape, you mentioned the sites of homes on the mountaintop. Oh, yeah, just two questions.
Yeah.
You mentioned the sites of homes on the top of Mount Washington. That is, the homes are there, not there anymore.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
Who were the people that lived up there?
Oh, I can't tell you too much about that, I'm sorry. Except that I know the Bonhotel family lived up there. And when you say houses, these were not really houses. These were cabins. These were temporary cabins. The Bonhotels lived down in the village some of the time, but they lived up there during the charcoal days. They lived up there in cabins. It was too far to travel up and down all the time. When you get to the Mount Washington area, and I mention Mount Washington because the charcoal was cut not only here, but ran up the ridge into the town of Mount Washington, which is in Massachusetts. The only family that I ever knew up there and who were there of long standing were the Whitbecks. And they were related distantly to the Sammy Whitbeck family here in town. I don't know exactly how they're related. But they lived up there for many, many years in Mount Washington. I can't tell you any more family names up there, I'm sorry to say.
And then, who were your inspirations, your heroes, when you were growing up, let's say in your teenage years? Who did you look up to?
Babe Ruth, I guess.
Right.
Babe Ruth, Jack Dempsey, uh-huh. Bill Tilden,
uh-huh.
all the super athletes, the greatest of the greats. I don't think, in later years, after my father was dead, he was my hero, but I never realized that.
I gathered that from what you heard, as you described him.
I never realized it until after he was dead, but I did learn later in life that he was my hero. Mm-hmm. Other than that, I don't think I had any local heroes. No one of heroic stature in this area that I can remember.
Is there anything else you want to add, Bob?
No, I can't think of anything. I hope this will prove of interest to someone someday. Maybe not for the present time, but maybe 50 or 100 years from now, someone will hear my voice and say, "Look, that was a strange character."
I'm sure most of
those were strange. And those were strange times. So I think that's about all I have to say.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you.